Hello, and moin moin, Center for International Maritime Security listeners. I am Roger Hilton, a non-resident academic fellow for the Institute for Security Policy at Keele University at its adjunct Center for Maritime Strategy and Security, welcoming you back for another edition of the Sea Control Series podcast. In case you missed it due to a tidal wave or even a shipwreck, back in June, the Keele International Sea Power Symposium took place in tandem with Keele Week, Europe's largest maritime festival and a traditional naval event. The symposium, or KISS for short, gathered an array of internationally recognized maritime and security experts from a diverse set of professional fields that combined with them emerging thought leaders in international security. While KISS 2018 was primarily focused on assessing the merits and current viability of the 2011 Allied Maritime Strategy, a major takeaway of the symposium that was impossible to overlook was the drastically changed security environment, highlighted by the return of great power politics. The intensifying competition between the United States, Russia, and China for control of strategic spaces has brought with it a slew of challenges and sadly installed a lower threshold for potential confrontation. Consequently, this new security dynamic has forced national policymakers to reconsider the importance of the maritime domain when it comes to global statecraft. Against the backdrop of this melee is Europe and its multinational assortment of maritime forces. On quick observation, the situation does not derive much confidence. Years of neglected force structure investment by European nations, coupled with the shifting American presence to Asia from the European theater, suggest a distressing situation. Consequently, based on these factors, it is only natural to ponder if Europe's naval forces are doomed to impotency for the foreseeable future, or if reform and power projection at sea is possible. Here with us today to help us navigate these questions, and of course choppy waters, is Jeremy Stoes, an Austrian-American defense analyst at the Institute for Security Policy at Keele University and its adjunct Center for Maritime Strategy and Security. In addition, he is also a non-resident fellow of the Austrian Center for Intelligence, Propaganda, and Security Studies. His current research and teaching focuses on transatlantic relations, maritime security, and European naval power. He has written various articles and chapters on the matter and is the author of the book The Decline of European Naval Forces, Challenges to Sea Power in an Age of Fiscal Austerity and Political Uncertainty. The Decline of European Naval Forces aims to provide insight into the evolution of Europe's naval forces since the end of the Cold War. To illuminate the drastic changes many European navies have undergone over the last 25 years, Jeremy analyzes the defense policies and naval strategies of 11 European states, as well as the evolution, deployment, and capabilities of their respective naval forces. Having at length discussed and debated maritime security issues with Jeremy, I can testify firsthand to his ability to provide exceptional analysis and expert commentary. Nobody understands these principles better than Jeremy, who will shed much-needed light on if Europe's maritime forces can be brought back from the brink. I am glad to say he is a titan of the maritime domain, akin to his Austrian countryman, Admiral Wilhelm von Tegeltoff, and it is my pleasure to welcome him aboard.
Well, thank you for having me, Roger. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
It cuts both ways, Jeremy. Before we dive in, it might be helpful to our listeners if we structure the conversation. That being said, we will cover three distinct periods as they relate to the decline of European naval forces. Period number one, 1990 to 2001, post-Cold War peace dividend. Period number two, 2001 to 2014, land wars in the age of global terrorism after 9/11. And period number three, 2014 to present, post-Crimea annexation. Jeremy, as it was established at KISS 2018, maritime security is back with a vengeance. Its relevancy when it comes to acting as the lodestar to project regional and global clout, as well as help maintain stability, are no longer in question. As a departure point, in your book, you cite both the concept of sea power and naval power. Very quickly, can you explain each concept and what specifically distinguishes them?
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. There is, as you probably infer, significant semantic awkwardness regarding these terms, and there are numerous definitions for sea power, for maritime power, for naval power. I like to paraphrase retired Admiral Chris Perry, who said along the lines of sea power being the investments, the combined investments of the sea of various resources of a state or enterprise in the pursuit of favorable outcomes. And we focus, and I focus on states, despite non-state actors gaining power in the world. But it's not only about investments or what Jeffrey Tills calls the inputs. Sea power is also about the outputs. So in other words, what capacity states have to influence human behavior and what when by what they do at sea. And as I mentioned, the state remains the basic unit of measurement for power distribution. So sea power, broadly speaking, would include all investments of a state, commercial, cultural, military, all of that in the maritime domain. And then naval power is but one part of sea power. So it's the military investment, if you will.
Jeremy, thanks for the description. Can you provide a contemporary example of each for the audience?
Well, because the two concepts are linked, there, I would not say that there is one example for one or the other. In order to have sea power, in my opinion, you need a certain degree of naval power. However, states might have significant maritime commercial interests on the one hand, but relatively little means or provide relatively little means for similarly large investments in naval power. Again, I refer to Jeffrey Till, Professor Till, who refers to that as the virtuous circle. So one investment into one area feeding off of the other, mutually beneficial, but also the circle can then run vicious, and decline in one area can affect decline in the other. And that's something that I believe we have seen in the past decades throughout Europe. It is important to remember that most every state, or probably every state on this planet, has some interest in the sea and at sea, and they enjoy different forms of agency at sea. Even a landlocked country like my home, Austria, has a part to play within the global trade regime and therefore also has stakes at sea. But generally speaking, to answer your question, sea power and naval power are linked. And today, I don't think that the difference between it's a different concept that it might have been 200 years ago, but they are inextricably linked.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy, I want to really thank you before we get into the first period about recognizing and reminding the audience that even, as you said, landlocked states really have a stake in the maritime domain and that they can't be players all sitting on the bench when it comes to regulation of this and interaction. So, as we enter the first stage on our Troika timeline, Jeremy, we have the post-Cold War peace dividend from 1990 to 2001. You describe in detail how this period started the initial erosion of naval capabilities and strategies. With the end of the Cold War, you, like many experts, declare that the existential threat of the USSR disappeared, and by extension led to the abandonment of naval doctrine. As this was a period of transition from sea control, sea denial, and territorial defense operations to power projection and operations in the littorals, how would you describe this transition, i.e., was the shift in capabilities for nations smooth or for others a regrettable experience?
Well, now, of course, we have the advantage of hindsight. And we, as we know, hindsight is always 20/20. But generally speaking, you are correct, although I would say this process was much more nuanced depending on the state and more nuanced than it might seem today. Two broad terms that are discernible during this period of time is states either adhering to traditional traditional strategy of territorial defense, or on the other hand, seeking greater power projection in all its forms, not only military, but also in terms of economics and so on. So those are those two opposing trends. But as always, I think that's very important to keep in mind. It was not black and white, but a continuum of change. So sometimes a government might have emphasized one area over the other. And because CPAR is an enduring element and has enduring elements, many of these developments were gradual. So I try to refrain from using revolutionary. I believe that's very incremental and not as revolutionary as we might make it out to be, because ships cannot be built overnight, and naval and maritime proficiencies can't be gained overnight. The capabilities in place throughout the 1990s were, to a certain degree, much the same as in the 1980s. So it was the same platforms, the same systems, the same people, largely working in unfamiliar waters, maybe, on sometimes in unfamiliar ways. And it is important to note that some navies and some states welcomed these new missions, whereas others were reluctant to join the post-Cold War euphoria. And this is, of course, linked to geostrategic freedom of action. So if you look at a state like Norway, with its proximity to a historical antagonist, in other words, Russia, or a state that has limited financial means, then it's more difficult to change your defense and naval policy. Therefore, I don't think there's a clear answer to your question.
Again, thanks for the clarification. I think it's a great first anchor that we've dropped here about sort of stating for the audience and for anybody listening that it's often overlooked that ships cannot be built overnight, and that this is a long-term process, which is, you know, a great sort of, as I said, anchor moving forward. This transition of doctrine segues nicely to my next point, Jeremy. The raison d'être, or the ethos of navies. Against the backdrop of this maritime landscape that essentially deprioritized traditional doctrine, based on your professional assessment and your research to date, how are navies in this time justifying their existence and even budgets to the legislative branch?
A difficult question to generalize, and it depends a lot on each navy, and I think there should be much more research on each navy, how the defense policies changed. But broadly speaking, during the 1980s, you see this in a period of easing tensions between East and West, the German reunification then in 89, that maintaining the previous spending levels in terms of defense were impossible. You see that already in British defense studies, such as the Options for Change, the white paper 1990, that clearly describes that the previous defense spending is no longer feasible. So how do they actually justify their existence? Well, it depends. You have the Scandinavian states, with exception for Denmark, justifying their existence through a continued threat to their territory, Russia still being the most powerful military or the greatest military power on the continent. The need to protect their exclusive economic zones was also, of course, an argument. It is important to remember that the provisions of UNCLOS came into force in 1994, elevating the importance of the exclusive economic zones even more so. And south, you have Greece and Turkey, which lived through a period of increased tension during the 1990s, even hostilities, obviously necessitating hikes in defense spending. And for the rest of Europe, by and large, countries place greater emphasis on projecting power, interventions, peace support operations, and such. And these often took place outside NATO's traditional area of operation, hence the term out of area. And naval forces were, of course, uniquely suited in this role due to their ability of being used in the three functions, basic functions, the military function, the diplomatic function, and the constabulary function. So clearly, in this period of fiscal austerity, defense planners obviously used every opportunity they got, but they're different from country to country.
Yeah, I really appreciate you stating how sort of you have to sort of look at the justification, their justification of existence and budgets on an ad hoc basis, case by case. And my first thought comes to mind is that there might be another book in the pipeline, maybe. But anybody out there, let's keep our fingers crossed. Continuing with the theme of transition, you make an astute observation that brown and green water navies evolved into blue water navies. Was this an evolution out of survival, or did this repurposing hold utility?
Well, it's that there are only a couple of examples where that actually occurred, and that has something to do with this trend towards power projection. During the Cold War, many European navies, as you know, were assigned with specific duties within their respective alliance. Anti-submarine warfare or mine warfare or slot protection, escort duties or amphibious assault. So they were quite limited due to the bipolar world order. And once these strictures were released, then states believed that they could, at least those states that believed that they enjoyed enough geostrategic freedom of action, sought to use naval forces to protect power. And an interesting point, those examples that maybe stick out are the German Navy or the Danish Navy, maybe to a less extent also the Belgian and the Spanish Navy, that they really sought power projection in different forms. But these navies were mainly, at least the German and the Danish Navy, are mainly green water navies, so operating close to shore with a little bit of operations, slot protection out and escort duties into the North Sea. But all of a sudden they would then become blue water navies operating far a great distance from home. But again, what is interesting, they then would go into the littorals at great distance. And so they are littoral navies just over great distance. So that's an interesting aspect of this whole blue water, brown water, green water debate. And yes, the repurposing, of course, had some utility for those navies. They were able to contribute to increasing number of peacekeeping operations that were emerging in the 1990s, crisis management is one of NATO's main roles and military interventions, of course, in the Balkans, for example, but also further afield. And we have numerous operations, Desert Storm, Yugoslavia Operation Desert Fox in the late 90s, the intervention in Sierra Leone in 2000 by the Brits, but also low-key humanitarian assistance and disaster relief efforts after catastrophes and so on. So a plethora of missions and operations.
Yeah, from personal experience, I would agree with you that the arms embargo against Yugoslavia really stood out as an example of this. So thanks for providing such a comprehensive list of operations. Jeremy, despite it being a time of economic prosperity and peace, you reference a series of relatively large-scale investments and procurement projects that took place during this period. Quickly, can you situate some of the naval hardware being bought and used at the time?
Sure. I provide a significant and a lot of examples in my book on procurement, on force structure. It's to a certain extent a platform-centric point of view, which has its advantages and disadvantages. But it's important to note that European defense industry was, of course, a powerful actor. If you will, it had an influence on how naval forces were how they were built, what they looked like, and protecting critical technology as well as jobs is, of course, one of the main concerns. Navies in the 1990s is important to remember. As I mentioned before, they can't be built overnight. So they were designed for the Cold War, for high-intensity war fighting. No matter if you look at the Italian Navy, the German Navy, Netherlands, they mm-hmm. were designed for war fighting, a lot of anti-submarine warfare and such, escort duties, mine warfare. And all of a sudden, you have this need for expeditionary operations. And what do you need for that? Well, you need multi-purpose surface combatants, but also landing platform docks, amphibious assault ships, helicopter carriers and such. So you see this trend. On the one hand, you need larger platforms for low-intensity operations. And at the same time, you still have all those procurement projects mm-hmm. that were developed and designed in the 1980s. And so there's a divergence between the strategic necessities or the security environment and what you need for that, and the procurement plans that are already in the pipeline. And therefore, you see throughout the 1990s, European countries developing air defense capabilities in terms of air defense destroyers, originating from the NATO replacement frigate 90. And then those are very, very capable ships that are commissioned at a time where, well, the threat of anti-ship missiles in the littorals are not all too great, and where European countries are deployed with sheer impunity. But of course, it has the advantage that you have important key industries that you can support, and it just goes to show that you have to be very prudent in your decision making, what strategic risk assessment and so on as forecasting is concerned.
I think you would agree that that prudence in decision making still carries over today, and might be sort of a useful compass moving forward for nation states as well as organizations. Just to recap, before moving on to the second period, we have described here a period that has somewhat hollowed out naval capabilities and also sort of altered the way in which navies were expected to act and justify financial budgets. Is there anything else you would like to add before moving on, Jeremy, that you think the audience should know or that we might have overlooked?
Well, regarding your last question, actually, because that maybe hasn't come out, the downscaling already happened during this period of time because you have a reduction in fiscal austerity, the peace dividend. So especially manpower-intense and maintenance-intense platforms, old vessels, old ships are decommissioned. You have downscaling. You have rationalization, but still it can be considered a period of relative plenty.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at especially at the scenarios and the threat scenarios at the time. And you had very capable platforms coming online, you had highly proficient crews and personnel. In particular, it is important to note that those capabilities that were being developed in Europe, for example, air defense destroyers such as the Horizon class, the Daring class, the British, but also the German anti-air frigates and so on. They were state of the art and are comparable to the best air defense destroyers in the world. So that is something where maybe Europe caught up in that period of time because they were good at sensor technology and so on. Also, the UK getting the Tomahawk land attack missiles for the subs. The French got their Charles de Gaulle aircraft carrier, only one. And then closer and closer cooperation between the states because of dwindling budgets and the need to streamline and the need to cooperate and on tactical and operational levels. And to a certain extent, one more point I might want to add is that the United States still had such great capabilities that they could compensate to a certain extent for the dwindling numbers among European naval power. So but it still proved, the 1990s proved how important actually naval forces and naval power was.
I mean, there's no doubt as we move on in the podcast here that we're going to return to the United States capabilities, compensating maybe too much for dwindling numbers of European naval power. But let's keep the listeners in check a little bit. So now we move on to the second period, Jeremy. Land wars in the age of global terrorism after 9/11, which took place between 2001 and 2014. This was a seminal moment, not just for European navies, but in world history. Not only did this period usher in two theater operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, but it also brought the global financial meltdown of 2007 and 2008, commonly referred to today as the Great Recession. Underscoring all of this, if that was not enough, was that on June 18, 2004, the first known U.S. drone strike took place in Wana, South Waziristan, Pakistan, which would ultimately usher in the drone wars, which we see now today. Suffice to say, Jeremy, these diverse episodes played a titanic role in altering the course of the development of European naval forces. Would you agree or challenge this?
Well, I would agree, but I would, however, caution not to over-dramatize the effects of this period. I mean,
spoken like a true admirable,
like a true Austrian, I don't know. No, it's, I grant you that the last decades, and that's what I also write in my book, and I've come to find out in my research, were very challenging for a European naval power and, of course, for the defense community in general in Europe. But it's also important to put it in a historic context. And for some European states, for the naval forces of some European states, including, you know, take the 19th century Spanish Armada Española or the 20th century German or Italian Navy, they have endured much greater calamities and decline than we have witnessed recently. But I grant you that this period, if you look at the last 30 years, if you will, since the reunification of Germany, so almost 30 years now, this period had the most significant impact on naval forces. I wouldn't say that it was necessarily the land wars or such, but actually just the decreasing defense spending, because that's more or less what shaped your naval forces.
Based on your answer, it's very encouraging to hear that while what took place during this period was less than optimal, it doesn't constitute, as you said, sort of greater calamities and decline of past navies of the 19th and 20th century. So there is still light at the end of the tunnel. Jeremy, there's a lot to get here in this period. So let's try to unpack this period one issue at a time. And we'll start with theater operations. So at the time, as we said, we're in Afghanistan and Iraq. So how did the preoccupation of Western defense departments with land wars recalibrate their position on navies?
There are a couple of points to keep in mind here. Is first of all, these operations, and we talk about the war against terror. I prefer the war against terrorism. I think it's the better term, but be it as it may. So you have military operations on land, but the naval forces play an important role in contributing to these campaigns, from airstrikes to cruise missiles to providing close air support and med evac and logistics and so on. So they're very important. At the same time, you have a broadening of the security agenda in general, generally speaking. That already occurs throughout the 1990s, but then picks up speed during the 2000s. And what 9/11 does, if you will, is not only the first case of Article 5,
Sorry, folks, we were under attack there with a bit of a technical difficulty. Apologies for my end. So, Jeremy, just to pick up where we left off, how did the preoccupation of Western defense departments with land wars recalibrate their position on navies?
There are two aspects that I think should be considered here. One is that, on the one hand, the attacks of 9/11 invoked or elicited Article 5, NATO's Article 5, to be invoked for the first time, and large numbers of European states contributed to the wars in Afghanistan, and somewhat fewer 2 years later to the U.S.-led invasion in Iraq. So they were deployed in combat operations on land. It is important, however, to remember that naval forces played a critical role in these land wars, from conducting airstrikes from carriers, launching mm-hmm. cruise missiles, inserting special forces, Marines, for example, into Afghanistan, providing air support, also logistics. So they played an important role. But what I think is even more interesting is that the attacks of 9/11 and the global war on terror changed the security environment, in such that you have a broadening security environment and broadening term understanding of the term security and the security agenda during the 1990s. And from the 1990s onwards, especially after 9/11, then the threat of terrorism as one of the challenges the naval forces have to deal with. So you see naval forces being deployed in lowest end of the intensity spectrum in anti-terrorism operations, anti-proliferation operations, especially against weapons of mass destruction, combating illegal trafficking, arms, drugs, people. So the concept of maritime security is prevalent during this period of time, and naval forces are assigned with dealing with all kinds of maritime security challenges, together with other agencies such as Coast Guards and so on.
I appreciate your answer, Jeremy. And again, I just think it's so useful that you're also explaining to people the logistical role that navies were playing, because it's often overlooked in theater operations how important it is about getting equipment and people and general resources across. So that's not something to be left out in any case as we review this. To follow up, it has been consistently argued that within this period that reasserted the dominance of the Army and Air Force, it by extension led to the deprioritization of naval capabilities. Against this military branch struggle, did it actually force navies to expand their repertoire of functions to become more versatile? I.e., was this sort of a blessing in disguise that they needed?
I think I know what you're getting at. I would have to say that really depends on each individual state. So I find it difficult to make general claims here. One thing that is clear is that air and land forces obviously received the lion's share of funding during this period of time, and in general, usually they get a greater portion of the defense budget. Mm-hmm. So we have similar developments in the U.S. as you see in Europe, especially in those wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, where young men and women are dying, that you prioritize capabilities that you need in war. For example, reducing the risk to the forces. And I remember the discussion quite vividly, and it's coming up now again, in investing in low-intensity capabilities such as mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles.
I agree with you completely, Jeremy. How could you forget sort of the stream of news with IEDs coming up? So to a certain degree, it was somewhat justified, I think, but continue.
Yeah, and that's always the problem, the high-low mix. The European, and therefore, I think it was Secretary of Defense Gates who slashed the F-22 program at 180-something airframes. And now they constantly bemoan the fact that they have so few of those. And that's always the question. You have the same problem you had a similar problem in Europe. But what this period of time does, I believe, is it really changes the functions of the navies, or the understanding of navies, the fundamental understanding of what their constabulary role is, what their diplomatic function is, and that is reflected in concepts such as the Thousand Ship Navy, the U.S. Cooperative Strategy, CS-21, from their maritime strategy, and the European efforts of capacity building, so really building partnership on the low level. And, of course, it's easier to build partnerships on the lower level instead of in the high end. So you see this growing cooperation, this cooperative approach to maritime missions. And, of course, what happens, this happens at the expense of warfighting capabilities. So especially anti-submarine warfare was rarely practiced. Offensive mining was but relinquished. Surface warfare is difficult to do when you lack surveillance assets such as maritime patrol aircraft. So you have the focus shifted maybe too much to the low end, but really really changed, I think, the perception of what navies can do. I think that is being forgotten again, though.
As the first part, Jeremy, I want to thank you again for sort of contextualizing the impact of the land wars. And now within this period, we're going to shift to the global financial meltdown. You state that after the end of the Cold War, many states had been able to consolidate their militaries despite fiscal restrictions. And again here, this all changed in 2007, 2008, against a groundswell of financial issues like tanking economies and failing financial sectors, and of course soaring national debts. You deduce that even previous levels of defense spending and the corresponding force structures were considered unsustainable in many cases. Consequently, it is evident that we have somewhat polarizing periods here. On the one hand, we have a reduced defense spending era of the post-Cold War compared to a restrictive and highly justifiable defense spending period of the late 2000s. So, Jeremy, can you help us explain, can you explain in detail the short and long-term impact that the global financial crisis had on national naval procurement?
Yes. I don't know if it would juxtapose the 1990s and the 2000s, but what I would argue is that the 1990s still, a lot of states invested heavily in modernizing their militaries, and you see real strengthening of naval forces. If you look at the Greek Navy, or the French are still spending quite a lot of on national defense. And then the real problem then really starts in 2000. So you might be right about that anyway. But purely from a platform-centric point of view, much of the damage to European navies began in the 2000s, I would say. You see the decommissioning of numerous vessels, numerous platforms without replacements. The Danish submarine flotilla, for example, or large parts of the Dutch escort fleet. You have problems with stretching procurement processes. You see that with the German and Spanish submarine programs. And this was exacerbated by the financial crisis, then really putting a hold on entire procurement projects, canceling them outright. My British colleagues and our British colleagues will attest to that, most infamously the cancellation of the British Nimrod maritime patrol aircraft, which left the Brits without any dedicated fixed-wing maritime surveillance platform. But this is just one of many examples.
Yeah. That's another great anchor you've sort of put down here for the audience and for myself, that this decline had initially began sort of in the mid-2000s, and what occurred after the global financial crisis just exacerbated it even more. So again, thank you for that clarification in terms of procurement. When it comes to a specific example, Jeremy, in your book, you describe a bleak picture of how, in addition to the decline in the 2000s, added with the financial crunch of 2007 and 2008, that it essentially removes some features of European navies, maybe for good. You cite the devastating example of the Dutch, who went from having one of the largest and most capable Cold War fleets to what some observers today believe to be a second-rate navy. Today, they are considered to be suffering from a lack of maritime awareness capability. Could you just elaborate on this example a bit for the audience?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that is maybe one of the best examples of decline in European naval power, example for decline, whereby this also happened or occurred before the financial crisis, and the Dutch defense studies postulated in 2003 and 2005, the maritime study or the naval study, they spelled out that the Navy has to find a new balance, and this meant selling six of their frigates to Belgium, I think Chile and Portugal, and would leave them with a fleet escort of a total of six frigates. And instead of buying new or procuring new frigates, they would get receive Holland-class OPVs, which, while being the Rolls-Royce of OPVs, don't have the fighting power of a frigate, of course. And then you have, at the same time, also in the early 2000s, the fleet of Squadron Orion maritime patrol aircraft being sold to Germany. And that all happened prior to the crisis. I think what the crisis then did in many countries, including the Netherlands, it significantly impacted training and readiness. And that will definitely have more of a long-term effect on naval forces. One, if I may add one example, is the new submarine that should be commissioned will probably be introduced sometime in 2028, 2030, something like that. And the current submarines will have reached 40 years, which is quite a long period of time. So that just shows these long procurement processes and the problems that has.
No, and no doubt, Jeremy, it really lends credence to our previous anchor that we laid about how sort of these procurement projects don't happen overnight and they take a long time. So this is just another example that, you know, provides a lot of context for the listeners. Let's shift to a bit of encouraging news. You know, despite the tight national purses at the time that were highlighting procurement, what are your thoughts in retrospect on the FREM project between France and Italy that was designed to build a multi-purpose frigate? In the book, you state that the project overall was deemed a success, but was still subject to economic limitations. Today, with more financial appetite for spending, is this a concept that can be recreated with success today?
I like the FREM, not only that I like the frigate itself, because I think they're beautiful ships, both the French and Italian version, but they're being, they might be the new American, the U.S. Navy frigate, so that is a first. But what I find interesting is that this Franco-Italian cooperation really worked well, and they learned their lessons from the previous cooperation, which was the Horizon project, air defense destroyer, but trilateral project between the Brits, the French, and the Italians, and which ultimately failed, or well, it did not fail, but it only produced two destroyers for France and Italy, whereas the Brits then went on to develop their own destroyer, the Daring class. But what they learn is that you don't have to build an identical ship, but actually can have some similarities. And at the end of the day, you have ships that aren't sister ships, but cousins. And that really is an example of how cooperation in the defense sector can work. But of course, yes, the French aren't procuring nearly as many as they had initially planned. But therefore, they're selling a lot to Morocco, and I think Egypt has received some too. So there are other examples, but that is one.
Okay. So Jeremy, as we round out the second period, I think it would be supremely useful to our listeners if we could sort of examine a case study. And none, as maybe you would agree or not, is more appetizing or relevant than the Greek and Turkish maritime capabilities. You've established earlier that, unlike most European nations, the Hellenic Navy had seen the fewest doctrinal changes over the past two decades, and that it remained focused on defending its adjacent waters and fulfilling its NATO obligations. At the same time, you assert that the balance of naval power in the region had already shifted in favor of traditional regional competitor Turkey. With the planned TCG Andalou L-408 expected to be completed by 2021, how do you forecast the maritime domain environment between these two allied members playing out over the next decade?
Thank you very much for that question. I really like that. Maybe also it was the most interesting case study to me, because those are two countries that during the 1990s and 2000 really adhered to a traditional defense, a national defense strategy, and that did not jump on the power projection bandwagon. And you only see it a little bit now with in terms of force structure and operations, Turkey going along those lines. But Greece is really adhering to territorial defense, SLOC protection. It has the fleet for that and so on. So you see a similar trajectory in recent years. Both have been able to shed unnecessary addendums. So a lot of the older combatants and ships that they had have been decommissioned. They have been effectively modernizing their fleet through this period of the 1990s and 2000s. And actually, both of them have larger fleets now than they had in the 1990s, and not only from the order of battle, but also more capable fleets relative to other powers. Greece, of course, was hit hard, very hard, by the economic crisis and its failing economy, and put a number of programs on hold, including fast attack craft, and of course this long story with acquiring German submarines, which are of course archetypical vessels for sea control. And Turkey, on the other hand, has incrementally been creating capable domestic defense sector. So they really are trying to trying to create their own capabilities and being able to build their own and construct their own weapon systems. And they're designing and building everything from tanks, UAVs, and now up to frigates. They start by building license building state-of-the-art German submarines, for example. And now, as you mentioned, the Spanish design on the Lu light aircraft carrier, which is a very interesting development, of course, power projection in its essence. But on the other hand, two caveats that I might want to add here is, on the one hand, both of them have challenges that they face. And one is, of course, fiscal for the Greeks. And for the Turks, I believe it's hard to imagine that after two consecutive purges, so I'm told within the military, that has not had a negative effect on the Navy. Because, while the current officers might be loyal to President Erdogan, but I would be looking over my shoulder if I were them. So, they have, particularly the Turkish Navy has to keep a close eye on the Russian fleet that, unlike in the Baltic, in my opinion, is considerably more powerful than a couple of years ago. But, yeah, I think it will be a development that is evolutionary rather than revolutionary, as long as Turkey remains in NATO, which I believe they will.
Yeah. What really stands out for me from our talk right now and your book is just sort of how Turkey is making this real shift to creating a capable domestic defense industry. I don't think that should be underlooked because, while a lot of countries have tried to do it successfully, the growing pains might be felt right now, but in the long term, if they can weather the storm that comes with the growing pains, it will be a real game changer, in my opinion. So, here we are, Jeremy, our third period, 2014 to present, post-Crimea annexation. As we see, we arrive here at this contemporary juncture for European navies in the post-Crimea annexation. The events perpetrated by the Kremlin and its Spetsnaz forces in March of 2014 set off waves of reverberations that are still being felt today. Consequently, the cacophony of relations between the West and Russia remain grounded in suspicion and hostility. As echoed at KISS 2018, Russia's annexation caught national policymakers and political leaders by surprise. In response, in their defense, actions taken since 2014, both by NATO and the EU, have to some degree addressed this previous complacency. At the most basic level, though, the Crimean event finally dislodged the notion that Europe could not be utterly dependent on US security guarantees. Compounding matters, as you state, is the proliferation of terrorist attacks by radical jihadists that have instilled a permanent sense of insecurity on the European continent. As if these challenges were not daunting enough, enter the wild card, which is American President Donald Trump's America First hypernationalism ideology and Washington's rebalancing toward the Indo-Pacific region. When taken together, these events have only amplified the sense of uncertainty when it comes to European security architecture. Consequently, Jeremy, is it little too late for Europe and naval forces to defend itself without the full support of Uncle Sam?
Defend itself against what? Or whom? You know, against a strategic nuclear attack or a tactical nuclear attack? Or do you mean defending oneself against a land grab in the Baltics, against terrorism? You know what I'm getting at. The U.S. has an interest in being engaged in Europe, and there's no doubt about it. Also militarily. And it's not that they are sort of altruistic. So I think for the foreseeable future, it is a pipe dream to believe that Europeans will gain strategic autonomy in the U.S. Mm-hmm. or become strategically autonomous. I think that is currently a buzzword that's being spread in Brussels or throughout Europe. What I've seen is that there are three areas that have been identified in terms of being autonomous. It's being strategically autonomous, being politically autonomous, and operationally autonomous, and then also, to a certain extent, industrial technological autonomy. And while I believe that, yes, there is a sense, if you will, in a globalized world, if there is such a thing as technological autonomy, I really find it difficult to believe that there will be operational autonomy in terms of if push comes to shove and European states are engaged or need to see the necessity to engage in high-intensity warfare or military campaign, they will need other European countries. Very importantly, it's not only the U.S. They will need other European countries and the U.S. To support them in some way. That's leading from behind, so perfectly fine. I don't mind that. But I don't see any scenario where that need will be, at least in the operational level, and hence a little bit on the political level, will diminish or will be lost. What they need is as much independence as possible, but that does not mean autonomy.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy, based on your answer, I think some of the policymakers up in Brussels would do well to take your cool, collected approach to it. Clearly, you're not blinking too quickly about it, but I think you offer a very realistic and pragmatic assessment of the situation. So thank you for that. As we said earlier, as a product of this tumult, you state how closer cooperation between Europe's armed forces has emerged. Can you speak to some of the completed and future programs, and if this cooperation model is viable long-term when it comes to naval forces?
Well, there are a row of programs that I could discuss now. What I think is important in times of fiscal austerity, there's a very interesting article on how European naval forces can deal with in times of fiscal austerity, I think from the mid-90s, and the authors provide four possibilities of dealing with fiscal austerity: shortcuts, so settle for less; jointness, so a service working with other services, military services; looking for cooperation with other states, so combined operations or multilateral operations. And then fourth would be leapfrogging or offsetting technologies, so using asymmetric weapons or just jumping, leapfrogging in technology in terms of, okay, you invest so much in high-end that you can offset your numbers, for example. And I think European navies have been doing everything, but they've been choosing a number, governments have been choosing number one too much, namely settling for less. There is no way around cooperating in close interoperability, which is the naughtiest problem, of course, but I have to say, we complain a lot, but there's no alliance is better at interoperability than NATO is. There is discussion of including Japan and Germany in the Five Eyes Agreement. You have a multitude of cooperation in terms of Finnish-Swedish naval cooperation. You have, I could go on, the Dutch-Belgian cooperation, German-Dutch amphibious forces, and so on. What I would personally like to see is the equivalent of a NATO AWACS, so early warning fleet that they have, or an equivalent to the tanker transport fleet. Something like that. I thought that when that deal didn't go over with regarding the Russian Mistral class, the French building two Mistral amphibious assault ships for France, that would have been an excellent possibility to trailblaze this idea of having a ship on the NATO flag, different countries providing the crew, having a French helicopter, and a German helicopter, and an Italian helicopter on there. But politically not feasible. What I've heard, they discussed it for 10 minutes and it was laid to rest. So maybe 10 years from now, we'll actually see something like that emerge.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy, based on the four routes, I can't help myself with this podcast having a bit of an alpine theme here, with you being Austrian and me having lived there for quite a while. I think it's really interesting to cite for the audience sort of the idea of the Austrian Special Forces on a German vessel in the Mediterranean.
Yes. I know where you're getting at. Well, at the beginning, I pointed out that even a landlocked country like Austria can have agency at sea. And Austrian Special Forces were deployed and embarked on a German vessel in an EU operation at sea. So 20 years ago, if you would have told somebody the EU is conducting naval operations in the Med, and they're Austrian from a neutral country, special forces embarked on that vessel, they probably would have thought you were crazy. But that just goes to show what naval forces can do and how important the system is, and that we all can contribute, and that sea power is shared.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we can't ask Leopold Fiegel what he would think, but overall, I think we would both say that's a great use of capabilities, especially sort of with, as you said, Austria being constitutionally a neutral country since 55. So here, Jeremy, we come to our last point in the third period, In parallel to this cooperation theme, you stress the need for nations to strike a capabilities balance, which is essentially the $10,000 question. So, in search of harmony, how do European nations reconcile investing resources in high-intensity capabilities aimed at, or deterring, if necessary, prosecuting conflict with other navies, rather than investing in low-intensity capabilities designed to ensure maintenance of the sea order? No pressure, Jeremy, no pressure.
$1 million question, yes. Well, in general, what I currently see, at least in some circles, is that the pendulum is swinging a little bit too far in one direction. And yes, I believe naval forces are built for war fighting. That's the primary mission. But I think people are readily forgetting about all the other things the naval forces can do, from constabulary duties to the diplomatic role. That is often brushed aside because it's not as attractive. Not as glamorous. So I think that is, we have to be careful that we don't only emphasize that, because I think for the first time, maybe in history, naval forces will have to do everything, because just the challenges are so great, and the range of missions runs the gamut of the intensity spectrum. And we can't just say, okay, we'll do collective defense and ASW, anti-submarine warfare, and we won't worry about dealing with migration, for example. So what I argue for, and of course there are a lot of qualifying elements, but niche specialization is important. And it provides small countries that have a very limited budget the ability to add something to the greater whole, to NATO, for example, or to the EU. But that can go too far. And what I argue for is this baseline capability that rich states such as Germany and Denmark, but maybe sort of the Netherlands, that they really, the UK, that they really invest in having balanced navies, that you have something that can conduct a wide range of missions and not niche specialize all too much more. I think that is dangerous because it limits your possibilities in the future and makes you very dependent on the others to come to your aid, which, NATO is all about, but it's in times like these, it seems not always, that certain that will be the case. The limit, of course, again, is GDP, is gross domestic product. It's the money is the arbiter of naval forces. So for Latvia or Slovenia, it will be difficult. But what is necessary is prudent thinking of what are the challenges, contributing to naval operations where it is possible, such as I mentioned the Austrian boarding team, Finnish boarding teams deployed in EU missions, or Swedish ships in the Horn of Africa, European naval vessels in anti-piracy operations. That is really something that is important. I would also argue, don't make the mistakes of the past. Maybe as a young scholar, it's something, because I didn't live through the Cold War, I just feel that everybody's reverting to that myopian view that it is so so it's comfortable because it's like the days of old, and we know what it's about. And a good example for this preoccupation I find here in the north of Europe is the threat in the Baltic. And Kaliningrad Oblast is described often by NATO zealots as a seemingly impenetrable fortress that renders all NATO and partner navies' vessels sitting ducks. So, they can't even get near there. And I want to refer to a colleague of ours from the Center for Naval Analyses in Alexandria, Virginia, Stephen Wills, who has a piece actually on SIMSEC of how the West got naval strategy entirely wrong in the 1960s and 70s. And then realized, they actually have a totally different strategy. And I wonder if today we have enough prudence and if we are getting our analysis right.
Yeah, I mean, just for our audience out there, I think what Jeremy's trying to tell you, if you're looking for your $1 million check, the answer to finding this question is balance. But Jeremy, I just can't resist that while you paint this very bleak picture of Kaliningrad Oblast, I'm sure Defense Minister Shoigu and his S-400s would tend to lean in the latter opinion. So, but thanks a lot for the clarity on that, especially with the example with Stephen Willis from which you can find on CIMIC. So, Jeremy, here we are. As we head to wrap up the Sea Control Series podcast, let's quickly return to our initial question of if Europe's naval forces are doomed to impotency for the foreseeable future, or if reform and power projection at sea is possible. Based on our discussion and your analysis of the three periods, how do you rate or forecast Europe's naval forces' chances for success?
Well, I would say if I wrote an article recently for the Naval War College Review titled Into the Abyss, and I argued that by 2014, the situation was quite bleak, I have to say. The decline was so pronounced in many of the navies that the capabilities were so atrophied that it really put, question NATO deterrence and the state's deterrence. And they were smaller than any time in recent history in naval forces. They lost capabilities. And the idea of deploying them in contested environments had almost been forgotten. So there was a preoccupation with low-intensity operations, anti-piracy operations. And the basic function, war fighting, had been forgotten to a certain extent. At the same time, I see light at the end of the tunnel. I know it's difficult for many people because they want to see change really quickly and they want to see defense budgets rise really, really quickly, and that translate into capabilities. But as I notioned at the beginning, in the 1990s, they were using the vessels designed in the 1970s and 1980s. So it will take time for the changes to take place, and we have to be very smart in the decisions we make in the risk assessment at the same time in defense spending. So, but I see light at the end of the tunnel what European naval forces are concerned.
Well, I think that's very encouraging again, and it seems as if that the formula for this this positivity you're sharing with us is basically an exercise in patience and prudence decision making when it comes to defense spending. So, looking towards the future, Jeremy, do you have any last strategic takeaways or issues that our audience should be conscious when it comes to European naval forces?
Well, I think for the listener and anybody who's interested in naval matters, it is important just to maybe scale down your expectations.
That's great. Scale down, yeah.
Especially what Europe can do. I mean, European navies and the militaries are very often juxtaposed to the United States, just because Europe as a whole is a little bit more populous, the GDP, accumulated GDP is a little bit higher, but that is similar, so it seems, and that is a very inviting comparison, but it just does not work, because Europe is has very different states with very different interests. Take Finland and Romania, for example. It is important to remember that the individual budgets of the defense budgets of the states are but a fraction of that of the U.S. And what is more important, because, of course, I deal with a lot of smaller navies, or smallish navies, it is important that they play an important role in the freedom of the seas and good order at sea, but also in military operations. And I think there's a necessity for far greater research regarding European naval forces, especially in the last three decades. There's very little comprehensive research on what they have been doing, what their policies were, why they changed, what the force structures were, and so on. So there are very few comprehensive studies on European post-Cold War navies. So I'm just trying to contribute to that a little bit. Finally, as we mentioned, strategic takeaway, without giving away too much of my findings in my book, I believe in an age of great power competition. It is very likely that the 21st century will be one of continued American naval power, despite all the naysayers. I believe it will be an era of rising Asian naval power. Mm-hmm. And the question is really to what degree it will be one of European sea power and naval power. So I much encourage your listener to reach out to us at the ISBK and the Center for Maritime Strategy and Security to discuss these pressing questions. We believe that shared power, or shared knowledge, is empowerment.
Well, on that note, Jeremy, I'm quite confident that I'm sure that this is not the last we've heard of you. And, you know, it's been nothing short of a real pleasure to have you on board. I, like our audience, is very grateful for your analysis and want to thank you for taking the time to help us better understand this pressing yet under-the-radar issue.
Well, thank you very much, Roger. Also, thank you very much for the compliment regarding Admiral Tegetov. I think I'll print it and frame it somewhere.
Well, you'll also be able to get those on Jeremy's upcoming book and website. If our listeners want to follow up on more of Jeremy's work, please be sure once again to check out his book, The Decline of European Naval Forces, or in the event you are looking to acquire a more refined outlook of the general maritime domain, the Rutledge Handbook of Naval Strategy and Security, edited by Sebastian Bruns and Joachim Kraus, is an indispensable resource to have. Above all, don't forget to visit www.kielseapowerseries.com for more info on the book and other podcasts, as well as follow us on Twitter through our @SeaPowerSeas handle for more regular updates. As always, ladies and gentlemen, with no shortage of maritime issues within the greater geopolitical landscape, you can count on me returning to keep SIMSIC listeners informed and briefed. From the Institute of Security Policy at Kiel University, I'm Roger Hilton, saying farewell and auf Wiedersehen.